Thank you very much indeed. This morning I should have said that the programme wasn't as published, and two of the speakers happened to make it. So the propaganda paper isn't going to be presented, nor is the presentation on the Nile by Dr. Nissi. But we do have standing in for a Nile presentation, Anna, and I'm sure she's going to provide a quite different perspective from the ones we have so far. So far we've had an important but relatively small catchment, a census between half and 1 cubic kilometers a year. So, in the case of the Nile, we have a modest size river, but it has tremendous problems because of its importance in antiquity. But in fact, it's quite a modest size river, about 84 cubic kilometers in their flow, and the Senegal, of course, is much smaller than that, and also a significant river. So we've got three different sizes of river, and that matters very much. I think much more important is that they exist in different parts of Africa, and especially in different political and hyper-political and international hyper-political landscapes. The approach of, and I'm very pleased that we had the presentation from Senegal, because in terms of the rules of the game, making the rules of the game in this difficult international world or context, has great progress that we've made in West Africa. From there, as the Nile, great advances are being made, of course, in Southern Africa on these transboundary arrangements. But in the Nile, we have a situation which is totally explained by variations in international politics, and that is what it tells us.
So, as my title indicates, I'm going to talk about power relations, conflict, and cooperation in the United States. So I'll be talking maybe more about politics than water, or politics related to water. So now I will explain some theoretical inputs, but of course I will introduce some facts about the basin. I will not take too much time about the details, but I mean to give an idea of what which basin I'll be talking about. And so my hydrology and politics, we have the map here. So basically here in the map we have the 10 riparian countries, and in green we have the basin, so the limits, the borders of the basin. We have one river, two sub-basins, so basically the White Nile coming from the equatorial countries and the Blue Nile coming from the high plateaus of Ethiopia. And just to mention that the hydrological but also the hydropolitical importance of the two basins is completely different, because the Blue Nile coming from Ethiopia contributes around 85% to the main river, so the water riding to pass from it. There is 10 riparians, so basically we have two northern countries, downstream countries, that is Egypt and Sudan, that are the main users of the water. And then we have seven other countries, eight other countries that share also the basin, even if it's not exactly the same proportion. Well, basically we have an unequal contribution and also an unequal utilization. The main user being Egypt, that's historically have been using the river for a long time and plan to have a historical right to the river, whatever that means in legal terms. And we have a main provider, that is Ethiopia, that contributes, as I told you, with three different basins to 85% of the water. So, just to have an idea, we have here a lot of disparity in terms of numbers, not just in terms of distribution, utilization, contribution, but also in terms of how the water is being managed. Just to have an idea of the resource availability, and I'm not going to explore very much this number, but basically, why is the internal water, renewable water resources available in the country, generated in the country, let's say, originated in the country, and in blue we have the actual renewable water resources, that include internal and external. As we see, Egypt has very few internal water resources and is mainly dependent of the Nile waters coming from the upstream of Nile countries. Sudan is in a better situation, let's say, in terms of availability, and Ethiopia does not receive water from any country. It's a pure upstreamer country, just contributing to them. And basically, this non, when it's the non-line, is the waters in Ethiopia that are not from the Nile basin. So around 100 110 is $9. Then in terms of so availability contribution was quite different, but when we look at the numbers of availability and utilization, we see that there is something wrong in the picture, because usually we associate that the upstreamer is the one that uses more water, is the user, is the one that has more dams. Usually this is the situation in all the places. Definitely here in the north is exactly the opposite. The downstream country is the one using the water. So in blue and white is the ones that we have seen before. In gray we have the total water withdrawal, and red the water that is from the Nile. So mainly Egypt is using much more water than what is available. This could be explained by other alternative sources. I'm not going to talk about this right now. And 55.5 billion cubic meters of water is from the Nile. Sudan is using around 40 billion cubic meters of water. These are the official numbers, because it could be much more. And Ethiopia, that has all these resources available, is not using much of it. So 55 billion cubic meters, but majority is not Nile water. So the other basins are very much exploited, but not the Nile basin. So when we see about the dependency and control, when we see, let's say, the dependency of external water resources, we have seen, for example, the case of Mozambique, that is not dependent, but is in a situation that is quite unstable because it's a downstream country. So, and we see here Egypt, that is a downstream provider, and it's 97% dependent on external water resources. So this is based on the previous numbers. Sudan is less dependent, but even so much, and Ethiopia 0%. But when we think about, so why is so dependent that has much more control? So how could we achieve this control? How did Egypt and Sudan achieve this control of the water resources? Why does it use billions of cubic meters of water and not the other countries? So first, we have technical control. Basically, these two countries have storage capacity that is much higher than the other countries. So we have Egypt, that these numbers are in billion liters of water. Egypt has the highest from them, that has the capacity for 169 billion cubic meters of water. That is quite a lot of water for the dimension of the region. And Sudan, that use part of it, and also has some other major dams. While the total storage capacity of Ethiopia is quite short. I just forgot to say, I'm going to mainly focus on the Blue Nile basin, so that is shared by these three countries, because it would be difficult to cover all the countries, and because my expertise is in this one, and because of the hydropolitical dimension of the basin. It's not just about technical control, it's not just about dams, it's also about legal control, because it's very rare to find legal agreements that have water allocations in the African continent, that have water allocations, volumetric water allocations, so how much is for each country. But in the United States, there is a legal agreement signed in 59, so it's 50 years ago, that is very clear about the allocations of the rights. 55.5 billion cubic meters for Egypt, 18.5 for Sudan, 10 for evapotranspiration, taking into account that we are in the middle of the Sahara Desert. But all the seven other countries were not including the legal agreement. So, and this is part of the problem in the land. This is part of the geopolitical problem and competency. So, basically, but now talking a little bit about conflict and cooperation, is this inequalities, inequity, leading to conflict? I mean, we have in one side the contribution to the river, in the other side we have the control, the utilization and the allocation. Is this leading to conflict? And I would say that it's mainly a conflict of interest. There is not a hard conflict between the countries in the Nile. It's mainly a conflict of interest and a conflict of discourses, of language. Language maybe here is not. In one side we have the downstream riparians, Egypt and Sudan, talk about historical rights, extreme dependence on the river, talking about new water, we have to conserve water, we have more water in the system, and talking about, let's say, okay, if the upstream countries want to use the water, they can have agriculture, but they cannot have irrigation, because we have a historical route to this amount of water. In the other side of the upstream riparians is this idea that the river is a transboundary river inside within our territory, so we should use this river for our for development, for our economic development. So they, instead of talking about historical and acquired rights, they talk about potential needs and use of the river. Of course, that this could be reached through storage infrastructures, irrigation, but I can't be very detailed, and instead of having all rays and diseases that for living in irrigation. And when we think about all this and about all these discourses and so on, we understand that power relations matter. And this this is a framework, hydroegemony. I can talk a little bit more about that and maybe in the question time, but they've been developed in the London Water Research Group that is this idea. What does it explain that one country or two countries are major users in investment? Why is this country in particular a hydrogen, so the leader in this space? And when we think about Egypt, for example, and then we have four types of power that we have been analyzing for each specific case, that would be geography, so basically the riparian position, that here we see that Ethiopia has a strong riparian position, but all the other elements of power, it's not exactly the case, but Egypt is very big in terms of control. Then we have material power, that we can define as power, economic and military power, bargaining power, negotiation level, how to, what are the powers that the countries have, the reference says that, and the actual power, how can, who is able to influence in this force, who is able to set the rules of the game, to call the shots. And we see here that Egypt is much more endowed with other material bargaining and national power, and that Sudan has a kind of neoliberal solution, and Ethiopia is very big, especially in terms of material power and national power, although it has some bargaining power, being the upstream countries can use this as a trump in the negotiation. Is using it or not, this is the question. So basically, we can identify two hydrolytic dynamics, that is the downstream countries trying to maintain the situation as it is, trying to maintain the status quo and the hegemonic configuration in the basin. And on the other side, we have the upstream countries that want to change the situation. So the status quo is not pleasing their goals, and they want to change. And there is quite a lot of things going on in the basin, and we could have historical analysis, or we could just think, for example, in this particular diagram in the case of the cooperation that is going on since the last decade. So but basically, there is this idea that the status quo maintenance is aimed by the downstream countries, while the status quo challenged by the upstream countries. And then there is this very good question that is, and what about the third parties? Because usually when we read things about cooperation in international river basins, is this idea that which is the goal of putting so much money in cooperation between these countries, and we are talking about $140 million invested by the donors, multiplied by bilateral donors in cooperation. But this is this power relations are still there. So this external backup, the third states, they are helping to change the regime or to legitimate the regime as it exists. So when we think about geopolitics are changing also. So we cannot make our analysis based on what was happening 20 years ago because things are moving. And when we see, so we have here the map are just these three countries. So before, and as a lot of people used to say, the only thing running downstream to this region is water. This used to be the case. There was nothing else. There is very few trade among the countries. There is very few even political relations, apart from some religious issues here and there, except maybe between Sudan and Egypt, that there was a colonial power in Egypt in Sudan. But things are changing. Oops, sorry. Things are changing, and not just water is running to this region. So for a long time that we have the support of the United States and the World Bank to water policies in Egypt, because of its geopolitical importance and so on and so forth, that I think that I mentioned, but this is not just the case anymore. There is not just one country receiving a certain help. We also have China investing heavily in Sudan into the oil, and then we could exploit a little bit this idea of the relation between oil and water politics, and Sudan it would be a very good case, that building dams in Sudan, for example. So, oil and water. China is also investing some money in job. It's not that much, but it's building sometimes. And sometimes it doesn't have to be investments, just has to be favorable contracts to build that, for example. And in this moment, this particular moment, there is two big large dams, being built, one in Sudan and one in Ethiopia, with Chinese. And then we have the World Bank. This was interesting in connected with what was talking in the morning. Ethiopia is one of the countries that the World Bank selected as the four countries in Africa that need the help of the World Bank, the investment of the World Bank in the water sector. And it's not just about water supply, but it's also infrastructure. So this is changing. This is to show how the geopolitics are changing and hydrogeology can be. Then we have also, that was also mentioned this morning, the livestock, and it also include, of course, food staples that are being exported from to outside the region. So the trade among the riparian countries is not that big, but there is a big trade. Sudan and Ethiopia are the two major exporters of livestock in Africa, mainly to the Middle East, in the case of Sudan, also to Egypt. This is water moving. Another, it's a virtual water, the concept developed by Tony Adamson, this idea that water is moving, it's not just the water running down the river. At the same time, we have the case of Egypt, and it's not a restaurant, this is a food purely imports, and this idea that a lot of water is also being imported to Egypt. 50% of the cereals, mainly cereals in Egypt, are being imported. And at the same time, there is also the export in our Chinese part. So, then cooperation. We have cooperation now ongoing, apparently cooperation. Is this equal to equity? We have economic digitalization benefits on one side and development on the other side. This looks like a very good case for the scenario, but might not be exactly the case. So, just talking a little bit about the non-investment cooperation, the non-investment initiative. So, it was also mentioned here another cooperative initiative that is much more developed and much more successful than the non-investment initiative, but was basically created in 1999 with the idea that you can have more production cooperation involving all the countries. Instead of having a big project, we have project by project, and instead of talking about water, we can talk about benefits that water can generate, as the godfather and architect that is the World Bank, and I would say that mainly the idea is to have an economic integration. But the water is just the reason to have this cooperation. The same time, we have the most difficult things, and usually it's a very sudden process, that is the negotiations for a cooperative framework agreement, basically a legal agreement that would include problematic water locations. But this is not the case because the debate now is just about the international business of international water law. And when we see this process, we understand that the Migrants Initiative will not move very much forward if a legal agreement is not found. Because there are certain countries when they become involved in the cooperation, what they want is an agreement. So, to try to mix the two things here, we have a cooperation process that is not involving the politics of the region, it's very likely that